Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and I'm very happy to be back with you here in front of the microphone. I've been spending so much time recently trying to get the virtual Natural History Museum campaign up and running that the podcast didn't really get the attention it deserved, and that's a shame. But now all the team have been out recording, so there's plenty coming up for you to look forward to. Regarding the campaign, things are up and running, but now we really need your help in getting the project fully funded. If you don't know what it is yet, where have you been? Please go immediately to the relevant section of our website and take a look at what we're trying to achieve. There's not long left for the campaign, so get donating and you'll be able to bag yourself some pretty cool rewards as well. This is a fantastic opportunity to revolutionise paleontological education and the accessibility of museum collections. We can't let this chance pass us by. Still talking about money, PaleoCast has been receiving some wonderful donations from you all. I was going to give a shout out to everyone that's donated, but we might be here for a while. We're going to treat ourselves and you to some new recording equipment to improve the audio quality of the show for everyone. Donations of any amount are welcomed, so if you enjoy the show, please consider it. And a massive thank you to everyone that's donated so far. Finally, I've edited and posted up all of our live stream videos from the Paleontological Association meeting in December. There's 36 presentations of all the latest paleontological research available for you to watch. And remember that you won't find anything like this anywhere except PaleoCast. Right, now that we've got the admin out of the way, this interview is with Ronny Rüssler of the Museum für Naturkunde in Chemnitz, Germany, and he's going to be telling us about the Permian forests that you can find underneath the city. So I first heard about this when I got wind of a new scorpion they'd found there, and then as I read more and more about this locality, I just couldn't believe that I'd never heard about it before. It really is something special. So this is a great interview and I really hope you enjoy it. And please don't forget that on our website we've got a load of pictures of the excavations and of the fossils. So give those a look. And then please also remember to share and like this post on social media. Hi Ronny, thank you very much for joining us today. One of the first things we'd like to do when we get new interviewees on the show is to get an insight into their route into paleontology and why they became a paleontologist. So how was it for you? How did you get into the field?
When I was a student at the Freiburg University of Mining and Technology, I was working on different fields of sedimentology and facies analysis and, of course, on the fossil record from drilling cores provided by natural gas companies, mainly for stratigraphic purposes. And therefore, I also studied to learn from the fossils, and I used them for biostratigraphy, for age determination, environment analysis, and to interregional correlations. And so I had a very large field of business.
So what kind of things did you look at for the biostratigraphy? Was it just normal microfossils like foraminifera or ostracods?
We used plant fossils, for instance, and conchostracans. Also several insect wings. Different groups show very interesting color patterns that change during time. And so we had different lines of evidence to be used in the biostratigraphy.
And then you became director of the Chemnitz Museum für Naturkunde, the Natural History Museum there. How did that come around?
I simply applied for this position after my PhD and the geological work for the industry. And fortunately, I got this job. And so I started with collection studies. I got access to the valuable historical literature here and to really exciting fossils and several specimens of this museum reach back to the very beginning of paleobotany. And so that's why it was logical to work on this amazing material.
And the museum in Chemnitz, does that just display fossils only from the Chemnitz locality that we're going to be talking about today?
Not only, but of course it is the focus. And the very interesting thing of our city is that it was built on a petrified forest, and we can say on a volcano. And this ecosystem is 291 million years old, and it was preserved by a series of volcanic eruptions. And this is a very interesting thing to show the organisms on the one hand side, and the way and the processes that lead to this preservation on the other hand. And so it is a really fantastic snapshot of the Permian.
So you say that Chemnitz was built on top of this petrified forest. Was it always known that it was on top of the petrified forest? When was it discovered?
The Chemnitz locality was discovered in the Middle Ages, but more reliable facts we know from the mid-18th century. Searching for precious stones, an officer of the Elector of Saxony found a huge petrified trunk with 12 roots still attached. And the majority of finds were made in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And since that time, Chemnitz became more and more famous as a petrified forest site. And only recently, as the most completely known Permian ecosystem worldwide.
During this time, did people appreciate what this petrified fossil forest was? Or did they just think it was some kind of curiosity? Like, why have these trees turned to stone?
Yeah, right. It was surely a kind of curiosity at the beginning. And the finds were very isolated. And so the final story that we know today was slowly developing.
Okay, and so what's the locality like now? If we were to go to Chemnitz, is there just the huge quarry filled with all of this fossilized forest that you can go up and see, or is it all completely covered by the city?
Unfortunately, it is. Everything is covered, and since the 1990s. New specimens have been recovered during construction work only, but all of them were unintentional because most of the fossil forest has been developed into this urban area. In 2008, we started the first really scientific excavation on a rather small area of about 400 square meters and around 5 to 6 meters deep. And so we started a quarry made by hand within a densely populated city. And the results, however, were unbelievable, comprising nearly 2,000 finds, trees, leaves still attached to branches, seeds, and the pollen organs, and for the first time, a number of animals and different interactions also between the organisms.
Wow, well, we'll get to that later, but first I'd like to kind of understand how it works with getting new fossils. Do you have some kind of agreement with the city that if there's to be any kind of excavations, that the museum can go and have a look for any of these fossils?
This was no problem. As a museum, we are part of the city, and it was a random, and we found a small area where this excavation became possible. And so we organized it, and our first intention was that it should be an excavation for a few months or a year or so. And at the end, it was an excavation for 4 years. And so also the results were very impressive.
And do people take an interest? I mean, this is a hand-built quarry that you made in the middle of the city. Did people come and always stop and have a look in and ask you what you were doing?
Yes, of course. They're very interested in seeing that and to see what scientists are doing all the time. And so we had to take one person permanent teaching and talking to the people, and on weekends we opened this small excavation, and it was very interesting to see that lots of people come. And of course we told our results to the newspaper and to the radio and TV. And then from different cities, people came on the weekend, and we had very interesting talks to the people. And every week we had to tune a little bit what we are going to present, because every week we had new finds, and we learned much from these from the situation. And so it was a rather exciting story for 4 years.
So speaking to anyone from Chemnitz, do you think they would appreciate that their city is built on this fossil forest?
Oh, it's hard to say. It's we always struggle for that it is appreciated by the officials. Mm-hmm. But the people living there were very interested and very helpful.
Okay, well, hopefully we've got everyone interested now. So let's have a discussion about this forest. Can you explain the paleo environment?
It seems the paleo environment should be a wet spot in a rather dry, red-colored landscape, probably a depression with a higher groundwater table, exposed to strong seasonality and surrounded by gentle highs during stronger rainfall. Sediments were transported into the basin, and dense vegetation flourished in the basin center only and were thinned out to the margins. There was no ground cover compared to most of our modern landscapes. So we have to anticipate an accelerated water cycle. The rainfall, the runoff, and evaporation were more rapidly than today, where we have grasses as widespread ground cover.
And what was the paleoclimate like?
Change of dry and wet seasons, and we can see this in the woody trees as an excellent paleo archive. They recorded these changes, and this is quite unusual to everything we know from the Carboniferous forests.
Okay, so is that like paleodendronology? Is it?
We try to do this a little bit, yes.
And the fossils are preserved well enough that you can actually look at the cross-section and see the rings.
Yes, of course. It's not every fossil, but we have a high number of very detailed and anatomically preserved trees that we use for this kind of paleodendrochronological studies.
Okay, so looking at the forest and its significance, we have the earlier forests in the Carboniferous. So this is the Permian, which comes after. So we have so much information from the Carboniferous. So what does the forest at Chemnitz tell us?
I think the significance is unquestionably related to the preservation of variety and the quality on the one hand side, and also to the diversity of organisms on the other hand, that we have in in one site. We call it a T0 assemblage, a fossil forest buried in growth position in a geological instant. And so these T0 assemblages are important paleoecological resources and offer special insights into the nature, into the structure and heterogeneity of this forest.
So how did the forest end up being, as you call it, a T0 assemblage? How was it frozen in an instant? Everything still in position?
Yes, we found at this small area 53 trunks still upright, standing in their growth positions and still rooting in their soil, in their substrate, that turned to Paleozoa. But this was a quite interesting situation to study which kind of trees we have, the animals among, and so it was a unique example compared to the quite interesting things from the Carboniferous, the paleoequatorial swamps. And but on the other hand, it's really a special thing what we have at Chemnitz.
So what was the process of fossilization?
The process, of course, is closely linked to the volcanism. Preservation is quite diverse, including finest plant tissues, anatomically preserved down to every cell, mineralized by silica and fluorspar. Otherwise, we have a lot of impressions. We have three-dimensionally preserved molds and casts according to the emplacement of the hot volcanic deposits. And preservation of the animals also span from simple imprints in the rock to delicate skin preservation of the reptiles. The bones and teeth are mineralized and three-dimensionally preserved too.
So what actually happened? Was it kind of like an ashfall that covered everything gently and gradually, or a pyroclastic flow that just completely swamped everything in one go?
We have a sum of all of these, right? Usually volcanic eruptions destroy biota. However, in Chemnitz, we had much luck. The volcanic activity started with airfoil tufts, which rained down to this forest like heavy snow. And step by step, twigs, branches, and even trees were broken, but they were rapidly covered and prevented from decay. And then volcanic activity became stronger and stronger, and huge trees were broken and aligned in the direction that this violent surge took. And finally, the whole forested landscape was entombed in volcanics without any evidence of survival. The type of eruption, an explosive one, of course, was quite comparable to the 1980s eruption of Mount St. Helens in the Cascades, northern or northwestern United States. This is an excellent modern analog, and I would love to study these types of volcanoes and the effect they have on the environment by myself in the future sometime.
Is there any thermal damage to the fossils? Like, do we have charcoal or anything preserved?
Damage, of course, but we have no charcoal because it was rapidly covered by volcanics. But what we see is some kind of fluid escape structures around the trees and also around the broken logs, because these logs were full of fluids and full of water. And then when the hot pyroclastic flow covered the whole scene, then these fluids became mobilized. And so we can see now halos around the trees, and we see special minerals that started to grow and to form. And so there is a special kind of damage, but on the other hand, also of preservation.
Okay, so if we look at the plants now, what kind of trees do we find at Chemnitz?
Well, there's a quite diverse plant life, different kinds of trees. Some of them have modern analogs, others, unfortunately, not compared to any modern kind of trees. One of the most frequent fossils are tree ferns, a few meters up to 10 meters high, and regarding their growth form, comparable to modern tree ferns that are well known from wet tropical environments. Another group developing up to 15 meters tall woody trees are the so-called calamites, large ancient horsetail trees, which by no means compare to their herbaceous modern relatives. Nevertheless, an interesting group sharing characters which guard the plants from seasonal dryness. Other plants are the extinct seed ferns, sharing features of both the ferns and seed plants and exhibiting quite different life strategies. And the highest trees, the extinct Corda Italiens, were precursors of our modern conifers or cone trees and reached more than 30 meters in height and about 2.5 meters in diameter at Chemnitz. In one of these trees, we counted 83 rings, and the proof of a long-lasting tree life and valuable archive of what happened during that life.
So what's the biggest tree you've actually found there?
The longest we excavated, it was more than 100 years ago, it was 27 meters length, but it was not complete. So we can expect that it was originally more than 30 meters in height. And the diameter, 2.5 meters. That's what we have as superlative.
That's quite a big tree.
Yeah, of course.
So I think you mentioned that we don't get any smaller plants, any shrubs or...
Yes. For instance, we recognized climbers, finger-thick plant axes winding on the tree's surfaces or small epiphytes in particular. Small ferns growing closely associated to tree ferns and often found hidden among their aerial roots. But that's the only thing. We don't have a typical ground cover as we would expect today. And so the majority of fossils is restricted to the trees and their direct associated climbing or epiphytic plants.
And how does this forest differ from the ones that we see in the Carboniferous?
I think the Chemnitz forest is a restricted relic, a wet spot in a rather extreme and hostile landscape, and nothing compares to the extended paleo-equatorial swamps of the Carboniferous period. Well, one of the most obvious differences is that the giant clubmoss trees dominating the Carboniferous peat-forming mires are strongly reduced to only one remaining species of the genus Sigillaria, a type of tall trees made more than 90% of bark. And we found only one specimen of this species among thousands of other trees. So the picture that we have from this forest is quite different.
And is that the same in the Permian in general? These trees that dominated in the Carboniferous have now really taken a hit and have a lot of reduced diversity. Or do you think that this is just something that is in the Chemnitz locality because of its paleo environment?
I think this is a general thing, and we have a number of old plants that came up from the Carboniferous, but we can also show characters of specialization, and they became more and more independent from climatic change. And we have very, very thick trees indicating an extended tree life, and to be sure that reproduction will work. And on the other side, we have also a number of innovations among these plants, and not only the old forms. Maybe among the conifers and herbaceous conifers arise, and this is a very innovative and interesting group that will be more present in later times in the Triassic and on.
Now, the most interesting aspect for me is that, as you said, it's a T0 assemblage. It's all still in life position. So, similar to the forest at Gilboa that we talked about in episode 4 of PaleoCast, can you see a lot of the spatial information and work out how the forest was laid out? And can you get that information from the Chemnitz forest as well?
Yes, of course. And in one of our last excavations, we discovered the 53 tree stumps of different kind, of different size and distance to each other, but still standing upright and still rooting in their substrate. Otherwise, we can recognize also deadwood trunks that even today belong to the usual recycling process in the forest. But it was only a very small area, our excavation of 400 square meters. And it's a very interesting thing to speculate that this forest would be present beneath the Hull city. And it should be so.
So if we turn to the animals now, what kinds do we find preserved in the forest?
Every forest also has animals, and however, only a few years ago, with the start of our excavation, the first animal finds succeeded. Among them are clusters of small snails, probably feeding on microorganisms at rotting logs and deadwood trunks. Further, amphibians. We have small ones without any legs and larger ones, the so-called areopetes. An important step was the first reptile found in 2009. And up to 2011, we found 5 skeletons currently being studied and described by specialists. Another interesting group are the arthropods, spider-like arachnids up to small diplopods, or even a leg of Arthropleura, the largest terrestrial arthropod that ever lived on Earth. And our find is the last evidence of this animal worldwide until it became extinct. One of the most spectacular examples are scorpions, the first complete scorpions from the Permian worldwide. And one of them found still in its burrow beneath a network of plant roots. And so, for the first time, we got the real chance to speak about a nearly complete ecosystem.
So you mentioned that the reptiles had skin impressions.
Yeah.
That's quite a good find, I think. Is there anything that we can learn about these reptiles?
I think so. This is currently in work by specialists, and I hope we can come out with some results maybe in a half year, and we can go to publish on this. It's interesting to see that we have different skeletons. And so we can work a complete osteology from these reptiles, skeletons. The skin preservation was very exciting to see first time. And I'm not a specialist of the vertebrates, but I hope that we can get interesting conclusions from that in the future.
And in the animals, can we see any changes since the Carboniferous period?
Oh, yes, we can. Well, the oldest or the old arthropod groups disappeared step by step, and a large number became extinct. We found the last representative of the arachnid order Trigonotarbids at Chemnitz, apparently primitive spider-like organisms, but lacking the ability to produce silk. And they appeared in the Silurian and became extinct in the Permian. And from Chemnitz... The Trigonotarbids. They appeared in the Silurian and became extinct in the Permian. And our scorpions are also very interesting. They were found closely associated with the other arthropods. The significant finds represent the first complete fossil scorpions from the Permian and suggest that at least one Carboniferous genus extended its range beyond the time of the traditional Euro-American coal forests. Other forms, like the reptiles, more and more diversified at this time. And our finds probably indicate tree climbers catching insects.
Have there been any unexpected surprises where you just found something that you had no idea would be there?
Of course. At the beginning of our excavation in 2008, nearly every animal find was unexpected, since there was no animal, even after 300 years collecting at the site. So this first scientific excavation was an amazing event, improving our knowledge and raising new questions, we can say, day by day.
Why is it that no animals were found? Did people just not think that there were any, so they weren't looking for animals?
It's not so easy to recognize them first time. And the horizon from which we got the majority of animals was at a depth of 5 meters. And in a normal daily life in a city, you will never have a trench of 5 meters depth. And so if this horizon is on the surface, it is always deeply weathered, and you will not have a real chance to recognize and to excavate the fossils. And in our excavation, it was possible because it was not so weathered and it was deep enough to be lithified. And we were able to extract it from the quarry. And of course, it's very small remains, like the Trigonotarbids, up to 12 millimeters length. And so you have to know what you are looking for.
In summary, then, do you think that Chemnitz represents a complete ecosystem?
Nearly complete, of course, but this kind of research to look for a food chain is still in progress. Our food web, we surely have a wide range of microorganisms. Feeding on them, we have the snails. In rotted logs, we found small coprolites, fossil fecal pellets made by small arthropods such as mites. We have wood-boring organisms that are proven by their traces, boring galleries in the wood. And At the top of the chain are the scorpions, predators in a number of habitats until now. So it is really interesting to bring all these single facts together, and a really food chain or food web will grow during the next month or years, of course.
So a lot of this has come around from the recent excavations in 2008. So is this really going to be the future of research in Chemnitz, working out the food webs and integrating all of these animals into the forests?
Today we have a second excavation that is being developed at this time. And of course we have a few finds now, but we also look at the geochemistry. We look at the paleozoal and its development. And so we collect more and more facts that are useful to interpret at the end the whole ecosystem and to understand this ecosystem. And this new excavation is scheduled maybe for 10 years. And so we have all the time we need to look very careful at the details and to do everything that we learned from the excavation on the other part of Chemnitz from 2008 to 11.
So it sounds like there's still going to be a lot of information that's going to come out of Chemnitz. So how important is it in understanding what's going on in the Permian?
The Chemnitz locality provides a lot of different fields. We have interesting plant life. We have a very interesting trees never found in other areas or sites in the world. Now all these animals came up, and so we have in one place a very good spectrum of everything, and the T0 situation is also very interesting, but it not so really compares to other fossil sites, especially in the Permian. Most fossil sites are known from lake sediments, and they sum up the fossils over a large range of time. And we have a very short snapshot, but a precise snapshot. And this should be the really interesting thing in Chemnitz.
Well, Ronnie, thank you very much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed this discussion, and hopefully we'll be able to follow all the work that comes out of Chemnitz. So thanks very much for joining us.
I hope so. Was good to talk with you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.